This is the Riot Act business profile. It's the 10th of December 2006, and today we're talking to Richard Griffiths, the National Secretary of the Regular Defence Force Welfare Association. Welcome to the profile, Richard.
Thank you very much, John.
Joining us today is Tim, also from the Riot Act. And our first question, Richard, is what is it that the Regular Defence Force Welfare Association sells?
We sell services to our members who are either current members or retired members of the Defence Forces, and those sorts of services can range from getting the government to understand problems, say with their pensions or their invalidity entitlements, compensation, which obviously means we have to be able to explain those things to our members, and we need to be able to explain the problems with those things to the government. So we're sort of piggy in the middle with those sorts of issues, and that's what we sell.
How long has the association been providing those sorts of services?
It was formed in 1959 because the ex-service personnel who came back from the Second World War, of course, had common interests, but were mainly volunteers who went to the war and came back. Then, of course, the regular military forces were developed, and it was found that their condition, they were in the military as a career, and their viewpoint, of course, was quite different to what the normal second AIF people were interested in, and they, of course, their issues were being dealt with largely by the RSL, and so a special association was formed. We had to be very careful that we didn't appear to be a trade union, otherwise the government and the military hierarchy would have been very, very concerned. Mm. And so it was set up as a sort of a body that lobbies very gently.
How does it actually differ from the RSL?
Well, the RSL is dealing with anybody who has returned from service, and that means returned from overseas service, although nowadays they're allowing regular members of the Defence Force to come in, but they're still, their primary focus, I speak on their behalf, I think, their primary focus is on people who have returned from service and their widows and their families, whereas our focus is on the conditions of regular Defence Force personnel.
Whether they've served overseas or not.
Whether they've served overseas or not, their career personnel.
How much time does this activity take up of yours?
Well, I'm officially only a part-time, 3 days a week. In reality, it seems to extend beyond that, and of course, if there's something urgent happening, so it can be anything from the 3 days to sort of 5 or 6 days a week. There are so many issues that could be dealt with. It's really a matter of prioritising them and trying to fit them into my time. We've got a national president here, but otherwise I'm the only paid member of the staff of the whole association.
Mm. So how many members do you have?
We've got about 6,000, which may sound surprising, but an issue, of course, is that for us is that the current members of the regular Defence Forces, first of all, they're in their jobs and they're busy, and they're being deployed at an incredible rate, going overseas and coming back again and going off to the Solomons and away to Iraq and then to Afghanistan. So they're too busy to worry about these sorts of things, and they don't look very far ahead. They're interested in survival in the here and now. We try to look at the issues for what happens to them in 20 years' time when some of their injuries, say, catch up with them or the effects of them being used in some trial start to become apparent. So they're not that interested normally when they're in the services, although we try to keep in touch with them. It's afterwards when problems arise that we get involved. Again, the government, of course, has quite a substantial system of looking after people, compensation and rehabilitation and such like. Again, the real issue for us is that we have to deal with the problem areas, the things that don't get solved by the system.
Mm.
Okay. Obviously, you base yourself in Canberra because of the large Defence Force capacity here.
Not true. We're in Canberra because, one, Defence Headquarters is here, yep. Two, Department of Veterans Affairs is here, three, the politicians are here.
What sort of other presence do you have around the country?
Well, we have branches in each of the states and territories. They actually handle the services to the individual members. So if somebody develops a problem with, say, hearing or something like that, years after their military service, and they need help with making claims through Department of Veterans Affairs, then say the state branch deals with that sort of individual thing. The national office, which is me and my national president, we deal with the policy issues, which in general are the things that affect large numbers of people.
Mm. Do you think it's possible to lobby the government effectively from anywhere other than Canberra?
Well, it is possible. It is difficult. It is very much easier if you bump into people in the street, if you're mixing with the politicians, if you're mixing with the public servants,
face to face,
you know, if they're in the same clubs as you are, if they go to church, you know, in the same place, if they go to church at all. If you're just basically having those sorts of interactions, it establishes, if nothing else, establishes a degree of trust which may otherwise not be there if you're a delegation arriving from, say, Sydney or Brisbane to present a case. And again, of course, opportunities can be taken because you are in Canberra. Somebody suddenly has half an hour free and they want to talk to you. That can be arranged short notice, whereas if you're anywhere else, then there are big problems in trying to get people. You know, there's got to be a schedule to come to Canberra. And the person, particularly if you're talking to a politician, you can get delegations being flying in from interstate to meet with a politician, and something is happening in federal parliament and that politician just cannot get away.
In that situation, would you still go and speak to someone on their staff, or would you just try and reschedule
the whole thing? Obviously, I would think that the people would speak to somebody on their staff, but it would depend on the politician, depend how many staff they had. If it was a minister, they may well have a staff member who could do some of the talking, but there would be a general feeling, I should imagine, of disappointment on behalf of, say, a delegation of that kind, whereas, as I say, in our case, we would happily say, OK, we'll just reschedule whenever the minister looks like being free, and we'll go and stand around the minister's secretary's timetable and do it there and then, you know,
right.
If they could.
Mm.
Richard, what do you think the biggest challenge that the association's faced getting to where it is today?
Getting the regular Defence Force members, the current serving members, interested, and getting the word out to them. We currently, I mean, that's our main one. It's a matter of membership. For us, of course, we can have the best developed arguments in the world, but ultimately when we go in to see a minister or minister's staff, they will say, how many members have you got? And we have to explain, well, we may only have 6,000 members, but they're fairly influential. Most of them are fairly influential people in that they are retired officers and often retired senior officers, and therefore they have good contacts into all sorts of places. And, of course, you then have the issue that the politicians don't really know how many of, say, the people who read our magazine are actually families of serving Defence Force people. And suddenly you have this multiplier effect. The 6,000 suddenly turns into 30,000, and if they're in the right places, then...
So a little bit like claimed circulation in the newspaper business.
Well, yes, that's right, except for us, of course, we don't claim circulation.
Right.
The newspapers may claim it, and then some people say that they pulp, you know, some of their documents, whereas we don't have that. We simply say we have 5,000 members who are actually sufficiently interested to be involved. I mean, and a lot of them, I haven't been down around some of the state branches in the last couple of weeks. I've only been in the job for 2 months, but having been down in the state branches, it is amazing how many retired service personnel are out there working on a voluntary capacity, not just with our association, but with all sorts of areas of Department of Veterans Affairs, you know, helping people make claims and sorting out issues where possible without them ever going to tribunals or courts or anything of that nature.
You mentioned a newsletter there as a means of promoting the association to new members. How else do you do that?
Well, the main way we get new members is when it's now called, it used to be called resettlement, it's now called transition, when somebody's leaving the Defence Force they get given transition seminar, go to transition seminars, and increasingly we're getting our people around the states to attend these seminars, explain who we are, what we do, and get them to pay their $25 and join up for a year, and so, or they actually they can join up for free from a seminar, and then they go become a regular subscriber, regular member of the association. But it's catching them just on the way up when they're still not thinking, of course, about the long term at that point. You know, they're leaving the Defence Force, they might have been in 12 years or 20 years, but they're looking at their next step into their career outside of the defence establishment. They're not too worried about things, but we think that their partners are increasingly, by that stage, concerned what will happen if he, you know, develops melanoma from overexposure to the sun, you know, sort of during that Solomon Islands deployment or something like that. It's the partners who are looking a bit further down the track because they've got these longer-term responsibilities. So we try and get to them.
What's been the most satisfying thing about running the RDFWA?
Well, I don't really run it. I just want to be represented on all sorts of things. But
with your work with them?
With the work, I think the most satisfying thing is seeing the enormous amount of work, useful work that's being done by the volunteers in the States. You know, it makes me very proud to see so many people doing so much for no money at all. There are big issues, you know, that affect regular service personnel. Politicians are very good at being... politicians like to be photographed with them and say how wonderful and unusual and unique they are, but when it comes to their conditions of service and such like, they try to treat them just like any other public servant.
Yeah, they don't like it when they talk back either, do they?
Well, talking back is very difficult for people who are in the Defence Forces, of course, because immediately the M word, mutiny, starts to rear its head. And so they have to be very careful how they talk back, which again is why we are quite useful, I suppose, because our association's got a lot of ex-very senior officers.
They can act on their behalf.
They can act on their behalf, as long as they're sufficiently connected to what the problems are with the current Defence Force personnel. Then having a retired general or an admiral or air vice marshal or something speak up, although people may say there's an old fogey talking, if they're talking sense, people will listen.
How do you feel in terms of influence, those quiet words in the ear compared to, say, a front page splash of a retired SAS captain speaking out?
Well, the problem with the front page splash is that it may trigger an immediate reaction, which is probably going to be to deny the issue, first of all. The issue really is we have to keep working with the politicians and their staffs and the public servants, you know, for years and years. And it's no good us embarrassing them, seeking to embarrass them or abuse them. It's a matter of we have to have a word in their ear, tell them about an issue that we think has arisen, and ideally never get our name in the papers, because the thing gets sorted out quietly.
Where do you see the association going in, say, 5 or 10 years? More of the same work?
More of the same work, as far as my particular position is concerned. I'd like to see me there for no more than about 5 years, and then have the association built up sufficiently to be able to employ a full-time staff, a couple of staff members. And so that's my personal goal for the association. I would think it need to be about 4 or 5 times as large. But the rate at which Defence Force personnel are now doing short-term periods with the Defence Force and then going into civilian life, the target population actually is increasing much faster than just this straight expansion of the Defence Force from 50,000 to about 65,000 that's going on at present would indicate.
In terms of running the association's offices here in Canberra, is there any aspects of local government policy or regulation that if there was one thing you could change would benefit your operations?
Well, local government doesn't affect us very much. obviously we're an association, and therefore we have to comply with the laws for associations and annual meetings and putting in our annual returns to the ACT Registrar General's office. Otherwise, though, we're quite lucky in a way in that our accommodation is provided by the Defence Force. It's in Duntroon. Mind you, it doesn't have any of the mod cons like air conditioning or running water or toilets. But
we have toilets nearby, though.
We have toilets. We have toilets about 50 metres away, and we have a roof over our head, and so we're really quite grateful.
And electricity.
For that. We have electricity. Right. Yes, we do that. Yeah. But in terms of local government, no, we don't get involved with local government issues.
What about on a federal government level? You know, what's a policy that could change that would make it much easier to operate?
Oh, I don't think the federal government would change policy. Well, I don't think there's any
if you
federal
could
government.
One.
I mean, our issues are we have issues with federal government policies with regard to the Defence Force.
Mm.
But in terms of us as an association dealing with the federal government, most of the things we've got set up are sort of functioning quite well. We have a relief trust fund, which obviously has to be audited, and that comes under the Tax Act, so people can make tax deductible donations to it, and we can disperse that to needy ex-service personnel, that sort of thing. We deal with a lot of government, a fair bit of government legislation in our own right, but I can't think of any particular problems that either federal or local government are causing for us.
Right. Just out of interest, do you find that the even if the audit wasn't required by government, it would still be something you'd want to be doing as an organisation anyway?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you want to be able to say to donors and such, like, look, we are squeaky clean. Mm. You know, this is how we've spent our money.
We're being responsible with the funds you're giving us.
Precisely, yes.
What do you think the biggest risk the association faces?
Oh, the biggest risks we've got is a funny one. There's a large number of ex-service organisations. Most of them are short-term associate organisations in that they are associated with a particular shared experience that a group of service people have withstood. For example, you may have heard of the F-111 deseal reseal project, which went terribly wrong.
This is where they were stuffing crewmen into was supposed to be disposable fuel tanks to make them ready for reuse.
They were climbing through the wing tanks, through the wing tanks of F-111s, and because the wings are so small, so narrow, they weren't wearing their protective gear, and they were trying to use quite nasty chemicals inside the tanks. Limited ventilation, no limited protective clothing. All done because of the need for speed, because this was the F-111s are still a major strategic asset of Australia, and they had to be got back into service as quickly as possible.
But those fuel tanks weren't initially designed by the Americans to be reused.
No, that's right. They weren't designed to be reused, and they weren't designed to last as long as we needed them to last. Now, again, these sorts of things, our general view is the defence view, that defence personnel are expected to be prepared to do dangerous things. But equally, on the other hand, our argument has always been that the government has to stand by these people afterwards. So, in other words, if they suffer, if you send somebody to Afghanistan and they get shot, you expect the government to look after them. Mm. You send somebody to stand in the desert in 1953... the British nuclear tests to see whether armies would be able to fight within 10 minutes of a nuclear bomb going off 5 miles away, then that's a fair enough ask of defence personnel. They're paid a little bit extra, and they've got certain obligations and responsibilities, but you do expect, if it turns out later that they've been subjected to something which is going to have nasty effects, you expect the government to stand by them and look after them.
Do you think with something like deseal, reseal, it was a case of don't ask, don't tell management, where people higher up just didn't want to know what they were doing to get the tanks back in service?
I don't know enough about certainly there's been inquiries and certainly been apologies, and there are attempts being made to recompense the people for it. unfortunately, we've got some of them. They're starting to die off at a fairly... It's starting to die off anyway, and I suspect it'll be an increasing rate fairly soon. And the pension and compensation arrangements appear to be rather slow right now, and so there's a few issues there. But those are the sorts of things you see that we're looking at. I mean, things like we think that there's an issue developing on use of depleted uranium ammunition. And that is very much analogous to what happened with the British nuclear tests, in that although the Australian forces don't use depleted uranium ammunition for armour-piercing shells, the US forces use them a lot in Bosnia, Afghanistan and Iraq. The things are solid shells. When they hit, they vaporise. That's how they actually transfer the kinetic energy of the shell into the armour that they hit. And they virtually vaporise, and you get these fine particles being blown all over the battlefield and all around the place. And, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq have got considerable, you know, winds, particularly in summertime. So the stuff is blown a long way. It's tiny particles. You probably wouldn't detect it if you walked over the place with a Geiger counter.
Well, they are depleted uranium.
There's one tiny little bit, but the thing is you can get these funny little isotopes in, you know, a particle that's got a funny isotope in it. And so all you're going to be able to do is in years to come, statistically, look at the group of people who served there and suddenly say, there's a whole incidence of... there's something we've got an above normal... an incidence of a particular kind of cancer caused by somebody who ingested this stuff. And Department of Veterans Affairs is now being much more cautious with, say, deployments. They're getting the Solomons people who've been to the Solomons, subject of medical trials and tests. And I hope that this will turn into longitudinal studies. So every 5 years they'll come back and test them, see whether they're, for example, developing any symptoms of some sort of illness perhaps associated with their anti-malarial drugs or whatever that they had to take, unique to that particular theatre.
Yeah. How do you feel about the results gained by class action litigation versus quiet lobbying in terms of getting compensation results for service personnel?
Well, I would just point to the Voyager compensation. That was, you know, the collision was February the 10th, I think it was, 1964. There are people still claiming, trying to get compensation through the courts.
Right. On the other hand, the Westralia victims got a very big payout just this week.
Yes. I think that was much more obvious, the ones who were people who were burnt in the Westralia. And also the media coverage of what it was like in the Westralia meant that the government had no option but to pay people who'd physically suffered.
So it's horses for courses?
Well, the other issue you're going to find is with Westralia, I think, is the people who, in 10 years' time, claim traumatic stress, whether it's genuine or whether it's not is a matter for others to decide. But the thing is that these are longer term things to be compensated. As I say, the government's record, though, on legal compensation avenues is very poor. 42 years or so for Voyager victims is more than a bit much, I think.
Do you think traumatic stress is something that should be considered to be an occupational hazard of defence?
It should be considered to be something which will occur with defence, but you can't. I don't think, unless the government is really going to jack up the salaries of defence personnel, I think they would find it was more sensible to pay those who suffer. Others can absorb that sort of stress, and maybe if the government got really, really clever with its recruiting, it could recruit those people who weren't going to suffer. You know, but right now they're so desperate for recruiting that I don't think that's likely to occur. I think they need the people, and they'll take almost anybody. I don't mean that in quite the sense of the
American. Which is probably indicative of the high turnover as well.
Well, retention
taking in the wrong people who decide they're not cut out.
Well, I think retention is a different issue with the military. I mean, the military salaries are quite good compared to civilian salaries in general for a 22-year-old going in. right now. But after the 22-year-old's been in, say, 6 or 8 years, and has got married, and has got kids, suddenly the idea of every 6 months disappearing on deployment or something is far less attractive.
Mm.
And that is, I think, the major issue for defence. Sure, they're not quite meeting their recruitment targets, but it's the separation rate of the people, once they've just started to become useful, they've been trained, and they're leaving the services. That's causing a lot of problems. And it's not just going to be solved, just by increasing salaries. There's got to be a lot of other conditions of service that get looked at. But certainly one of the things that the government's got to look at carefully is to develop for itself a reputation for standing by its personnel when they exhibit signs of problems later down the track.
Are there any other things you'd like to share with our audience?
Oh, no, just that, it's rather interesting being in the lobbying game in Canberra after being on the other side of the coin in the media for so many years. It is very interesting trying to work out the pros and cons of going public versus the quiet word in the ear. There's obviously places for both. I do feel sorry for some groups that go one way or the other, particularly people who try to pull stunts and things like that. They get some media coverage, but in the longer term, I don't think they do so well. I think they get marked down as being difficult and suffer for it. It really is quite a challenging sort of business.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.